The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
My guest this morning is a Polish actress and filmmaker based in Dublin who has a story to tell about what happens when you lose your identity. Her name is Kamila Dedina and she's with us in studio this morning. Kamila, you're so welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Tell us a little bit about life at the beginning for you. What part of the world are you from and what was it like when you were growing up?
I'm originally from Poland. It's a small town that I come from in the south of Poland. It's set in the mountains and it's a type of place where everybody knows everybody. It's a very small community. It was a fairly standard kind of Polish upbringing, if you will, when I was growing up.
The place you grew up in, your mother was doing what for a living when you were little?
She was a hairdresser. She was a very successful hairdresser. She had her own salon.
And she was a great mother, obviously. And
she was, yes.
And doing all those things. Your father, a little more tricky.
That is correct.
Right, tell me about him.
My dad, God bless his soul, if I may say so, was an alcoholic ever since I remember. So when we were growing up, he never held a proper job. When he was sober, he loved my mom and me and my sister to bits, and he was amazing. When he was drunk, he, you know, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, typical kind of scenario. When he was drinking, he would get violent, particularly verbally, in terms of like emotional abuse, but occasionally my mom was subject to kind of physical violence, is the way to call it, as well. So yeah, it was certainly never boring.
lots happening all the time. Your family then would have been, like so many Polish people, Catholic, religion-wise.
Yes, although we were never particularly devoted, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, of course you do, yeah.
We would show up. I think the last time I was in church personally was when I was five. You know, my mom and my family would be, I mean, my mom and my dad wouldn't be very practicing. The other part of my family would be very, very Catholic.
Okay, but it was in the the ether, as it were.
Certainly, yeah.
And with that in mind, there would have been you know, regular knocks on the door from the other religion coming to say hello and tell me about that.
Jehovah's Witnesses, yes. Actually, the main way I think my mom met Jehovah's Witnesses, or the main channel, if you will, was through her work as a hairdresser. She had clients that were Jehovah's Witnesses over the years, and they sort of plant, you know, regularly would plant that seed and leave some literature and also knock on the doors eventually as well. I think it was a many years long process that they would sort of approach my mom over time, and gradually that seed that they planted grew.
Which brings you to when you were about 10 and the meeting started to become come into your life.
Apparently, I was the one who would like drag or encourage my mom to go to the meetings. Even if she wasn't feeling like, you know, she would come from work and be tired, and I was the one onto her. Come on, Mom, we're going to a meeting. I think the reason for that was I was getting a lot of attention from Jehovah's Witnesses as a kid. I was very articulate and I was kind of smiley and, I don't know, cheerful, and I think they just loved it. And I very quickly discovered that dependency. If I was, you know, nice, if I was attentive, if I was engaged with Jehovah's Witnesses in a meeting or in my Bible study, they would show me a huge amount of attention and love and appreciation. And it was like an absolute drug.
Can I ask you a little bit about the Jehovah's Witness religion?
Sure.
Because I know little or nothing about it. Obviously, I know that they knock on doors. They're always very pleasant. But I really have never investigated. What are the big beliefs there versus compared to the Catholic Church, for example, given that you know both?
Jehovah's Witnesses believe that we do live in the last days of what they call this system of things, which is basically the current state of affairs in the world. And they believe that Armageddon, which is an apocalyptic, terrible war, if you will, between God and the rest of the world, is coming imminently. The dominant mindset of a Jehovah's Witness is centered around obedience to Jehovah, who they think is basically God. But anything that Jehovah says, quote unquote, is distilled and distributed through the governing body of Jehovah's Witnesses, which is basically like a board.
Board of directors.
Of directors, if you will. Although they would never call that, you know, they would never use that.
No, but that's a metaphor.
Yeah, it's about seven people in New York City who run Jehovah's Witnesses from the headquarters. So all the minuscule in or countless, if you will, rules that regulate the life of a Jehovah's Witness come from there through those people, through the literature that they distribute around the world.
The knocking on the doors then, is that part of their religious mission?
Oh, it's the core of, you could nearly say it's the core of their religious mission, in so much as they believe they need to save as many people as they can before the Armageddon comes. So the idea is basically anyone who isn't the Jehovah's Witnesses, be it a child or an adult or a person of any sort of, you know, state, will die if they don't become a Jehovah's Witness.
Okay.
So the preaching, the proselytizing, knocking on doors has at its purpose saving people's lives. That's the way Jehovah's Witnesses see it. And that's why they're so, you know, adamant and persistent at it, because it's...
It's their belief.
It's their belief,
If you believe that strongly, that's what you want to do.
Exactly.
So when you were getting a little older, into your teens, for example, you were going to your regular school, as well as the being part of the Jehovah Witness family, if you like.
That's right.
And how did you feel compared to your other classmates, for example?
Very quickly, you know, as a Jehovah's Witness, I developed a sense of superiority, which is, I think it's common to many witnesses over other people. So it gives you a huge psychological reward when you feel better than other people. And even if, you know, you don't make as many friends or you feel kind of awkward in school because, you don't celebrate this or the other, you still feel better.
Why?
Because you're chosen by God. You're a member of the one true religion.
Like an elite.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very much so, like an elite. And it feels great, you know.
Okay, okay.
The secondary school was amazing because I made very close friends in my class with girls that weren't Jehovah's Witnesses, but they were very arty. They had a band and I became their manager, quote unquote, because I would have wanted to sing, but it wasn't something you'd really be allowed as a Jehovah's Witness. It would have been very much frowned upon. So I became their manager, and by proxy, I was able to, you know, participate in that arty life. The secondary school was the first time I started feeling a bit, maybe there was something off about the religion, but it was so subtle. It was, you know, nearly unnoticeable. The university was where everything basically fell apart.
And before you go there, before we go to university, I want to ask you a little bit about things like, I'm intrigued by the baptism ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Could you paint the picture for us about that? How old were you and where do you go for such an occasion?
I was 13, and typically when you get baptized as a Jehovah's Witness, it happens at a annual assembly, which is basically like a congregation meeting, except it's multiple congregations. So it can be anything from, like, I don't know, 500 people present to, you know, 8 or 10,000 or more. You'd go to typically a sports stadium that's rented for the occasion. So my baptism took place in Wrocław at a sports pitch during a summer congregation. So, you know, it's blasting heat. The pitch, the green part?
Yeah, the pitch.
You set a portable swimming pool, small, like, you know, kind of the size of this table here. Sure. And people basically line up in a queue, in modest swimsuits, very importantly. And elders from the congregation stand in the water, and they wear like a t-shirt and shorts. And one by one, when your turn comes, you step up to, or, you know, step into the pool, and you get immersed underwater briefly. That's the story.
tell me, as you were getting into your teens and as your involvement in the Jehovah's Witness was continuing, what was your father saying?
At the early kind of stages of us getting with Jehovah's Witnesses, I know my dad was very opposed to it. And especially when he was drunk, he would, like, make a scene. He would tear the literature apart and cause a terrible kerfuffle. The thing that he did, because, you know, he would read some of those magazines and very quickly grasp the basic ideas. And one of the basic ideas is that the wives should obey their husbands, and they're, you know, inferior to their husbands.
Right.
It's very patriarchal way of life.
I see.
So he held on to that, and he would give out to my mom and me as well in time that we weren't, you know, treating him well. we weren't obedient and we weren't, you know.
Wasn't he smart enough to pick what he needed from the literature, you know, in his sober moment and then use it against you in an angry moment?
He certainly was clever that. So there was that initially, but and, you know, it was tough. But with time, because he had a stint in prison when I was about 10 or 11 for emotional abuse of the family. He was jailed for 6 months. And after that, he kind of, I think he noticed that my mom did indeed change a bit as a Jehovah's Witness and maybe became less, you know, they were at each other's throats less.
Okay. So the daughter of an alcoholic, I do understand that. It's a line that I think a lot of people listening in will understand this morning for sure. How did the Jehovah's Witness feel about third level education?
Well, as a kind of a baseline or default behavior, they wouldn't encourage it and they would frown upon it.
Okay.
And that's because you're basically, you're encouraged to style your life or shape your life in a way that allows you to devote maximum possible amount of time to preaching, to being an exemplary Jehovah's Witness, to going to meetings, to preparing for meetings, to reading the Bible, to praying and all that stuff. And ideally, your job will be non-demanding, you know, part-time if you can help it.
But menial?
Menial, ideally, yes. Just so it doesn't, you know, definitely not a career that's all-consuming. You know, it conflicts with your life.
Okay, so you're clearly extremely bright and, you know, questioning, and yet you're a little indoctrinated by your religious upbringing. How do you deal with the demands of Jehovah's Witness and that family versus the demands of your own loyalty to yourself and your intellect?
Well, oh goodness.
It's a battle, isn't it?
When you ask it like that, I'm suddenly thinking, Jesus, I had it tough. well, you know what? I think in secondary school, so, you know, those years when your personality as an adult is kind of really shaping between 15 and 19, I actually had an amazing group of friends, both in my secondary school who weren't Jehovah's Witnesses and friends from the congregation who were just as devoted as me, Jehovah's Witnesses. And I had a very strong sense of belonging and a sense of community with both of those groups. I don't know how I managed not to lose my mind, because they were, you know, they were conflicting and they were tearing me in opposite directions. But somehow, I couldn't tell you how I did it. I just remember I had a great time. The 4 years of secondary school were one of the best times in my life.
And did you make a decision, an executive decision, in your own mind to leave the Jehovah's Witness, or was it a gradual process?
It was very much a gradual process, and it came years later when I was, you know, at university. When I did go to university, that's when that question you ask, you know, my own sort of identity, my own needs as a human being, my intellectual needs, my emotional needs, started really banging on the door inside me and demanding attention, you know. So the way it manifested itself was basically I became horrifically depressed when I was kind of at my first year at university.
Why?
I think it was mostly because I was plucked out from a safe environment and dropped in an empty space, and just felt really lonely. And I think that's how it started, you know, that I just, the loneliness and the lack of my normal routine and my community that I was used to made me just feel very alienated. And then that's when being a Jehovah's Witness became really, you know, jarring, when I was, as a peer among other students, people who were basically adults, and they had very, you know, set worldviews. I just kind of remember realizing that I know nothing. I know nothing about politics. I know nothing about economy. I'm kind of stupid and, you know, ignorant and lost.
How do you leave the Jehovah's Witness in a way that isn't very difficult?
Great. There isn't a way to leave Jehovah's Witnesses that isn't extremely difficult.
So what did you do?
For me, that process took years. It took at least, I think, 3 or 4, maybe 5 years even. It was, I compare it to the process of, you know, water eroding the bottom of a river. It's just almost imperceptibly slow. And the reason for that is, now, mind you, I don't know that every single Jehovah's Witnesses experiences it as deeply as I did when I was leaving. But I think a lot do. Being a Jehovah's Witness for me was in my DNA. It was who I was. It was everything, you know, it was running through my veins, if you will. So separating myself from that identity was... I like movies. So I, you know, like those 80s gory horrors, like The Fly. You know, when Jeff Goldblum transforms into a fly and like he's got things like breaking and sprouting through and they break his skin and they pop out and it's loud and disgusting and painful and full of awful things mentally and emotionally. That's how it felt. I'm laughing, but it was really actually harrowing. You know, it's just so many years have passed that I kind of like I look at the, I suppose, brighter sides of it. But it was an experience of animal terror where over time I just, you know, I followed emotions in my as my way of exiting the religion rather than intellect.
So if you say it was a time of animal terror, what was terrifying you?
Not knowing what was going to happen to me, not knowing who I was, not knowing what I want, not knowing anything about anything. That's how it felt, you know?
And your Jehovah family, did they become aware that you were leaving, you were drifting? And if so, how did they cope with it and how did they deal with you?
You know, the way it manifested for me, it was I just stopped being a super engaged Jehovah's Witness. I stopped being going to, you know, to service or preaching to other people all the time. I stopped going to meetings. And if I did go, I was just kind of sitting in the background like a mannequin. And what I experienced as a reaction was somebody called it, interestingly, preemptive shunning, which is... Jehovah's Witnesses practice this thing, you know, it's safe to make friends with other Jehovah's Witnesses, obviously, and that's what you should do, but only if they are exemplary Jehovah's Witnesses. If they express any sort of doubts about the religion, then they are huge, there's a huge red light or a flag around them. Don't go near them, better not associate with them because, you know, they're dodged. They can change your mind about God and you don't want that. So what I experienced was just, I lost my friends. Most of them turned away from me and they wouldn't, you know, speak to me. They started ignoring me, which was my guide in exiting the religion ultimately.
So even if you were in a room looking at these people who were formerly your friends, were you... Do they look away from you? Or
well,
do they pretend you didn't exist?
They just wouldn't kind of come up to you and have a chat or express any interest in how you are. And like not every single one of my friends behaves that way, by the way, but majority, you know. It's kind of like distancing yourself. The contrast was so huge between how I was treated when I was, you know, giving it socks and then I wasn't giving it socks and I was, you know, suddenly... invisible. So that was my guide in exiting, in the sense of this is how I noticed that something is really wrong.
I get the sense though that rather than them being mean or necessarily cruel, I get the sense that, if to use a modern sort of expression, they were ghosting you.
Absolutely.
You know, almost quietly saying, we're done.
That's
it. Is that it? So it's not a really mean get out, and you know, I hear of other religions where they can haunt you.
No, definitely it would be passive, kind of like ghosting, like you said. The Jehovah's Witnesses would never really actively lash out, anyway, because their religion kind of.
So when you went down that garden path from the front door of the church, metaphorically, and you got down the garden path, which was weaving through briars and bushes and all sorts of things, you got to the gate, you get out of the gate, you close it behind you and you breathe, you're out. How did that feel?
That moment when being out started feeling good, that came even later. Initially, just being out was I felt like I was going to die, you know? But eventually, I suppose, you know, day by day, the freedom of being able to do whatever I wanted or taking up any job I wanted or reading any book I wanted or watching any movie I wanted and so on, that was exhilarating.
I'm intrigued by the fact that, as a movie lover, the reason that you as a Polish person find yourself living in Ireland in 2020 comes from a movie you saw as a 14-year-old. And imagine the impact. Little did you think, watching this film at the age of 14, where the roads would lead. It's crazy. Tell us about the movie and why you loved it so much.
Well, I was incredibly romantic when I was, you know, an adolescent girl. And my sister had a VHS tape of Braveheart by Mel Gibson. And one rainy afternoon, I remember putting it on and I didn't know anything about it before watching it. And I was incredibly swept away by the story, obviously. I cried my eyes out. It was so intense and riveting and beautiful. But also the landscapes. At the time, I don't think I knew it was Ireland. I was just like thinking, oh my God, Scotland is so beautiful. And then when I went to university years later and I sort of had my first regular access to internet in a library there, I Googled it. You know, the making of the film. And I learned, oh, wow, it's actually Ireland where, you know, the Wicklow Mountains, where it was mostly shot or, you know, to a large extent. And I do remember in that moment deciding that I wanted to live in Ireland because it is the most beautiful country in the entire world and magical and, you know, stunning. And that was, that's the reason I'm here.
If you hadn't Googled, you'd probably be in Scotland now talking to some guy on a radio
in Edinburgh. I wouldn't be surprised, yeah.
But here you are, you did, and you got your flight from Poland and you came to Dublin. You worked in a coffee shop for a while and you worked in an office for a little while trying to find your way. And ultimately, you realized, you know, it was acting, it was movies, it was you've been peppering our conversation with talk of movies and so forth. That's where you wanted to be. So what do you do now?
I'm a filmmaker. Yes. So I'm working on my third film at the moment. I'm also an actress, mostly theatre. My latest film project is called Debutante, and it's a short narrative drama which explores the world of Jehovah's Witnesses. So it's this time in my life when I'm ready to sort of take that on in a way that I very much intend to be respectful and compassionate towards the members of the religion, while also discussing or showing the impact of very overbearing religious control and shunning on an impact of a teenager.
Because
on a life of a teenager.
On the life of a teenager, I understand. If I understand your relationship with the Jehovah's Witness isn't one based on any animosity necessarily. It's just more curiosity, or at least that sense of wondering why it has to be so.
Yes, it's a form of, I think, in making this film, you know, it's a form of reconciliation for me. I feel like I have a lot to say about you know, what I think is difficult and hurtful inside that organization. And the film is my creative way of expressing that, of dealing with that, for myself as much as, you know, for the public kind of benefit, if you will. But it definitely isn't meant to be like a propaganda film. Jehovah's Witnesses are bad people.
Yeah.
It's none of that.
It's an exploration rather than...
Exactly.
Than that. So how many years are you living here now, Camila?
12 and a half, I think.
12 and a half years. Yeah. And are you happy that you made the move to Ireland?
Oh, God, yeah. I love it here. To be honest with you, Dublin has felt like home for many years. I have only really experienced good times here in terms of like people I met and adventures, if you will, and work to a large degree as well. The people that I met, the Irish people, they're just super friendly. And I feel like we have a lot in common in the way we look at things. I like the Irish sort of, not cynicism, but this kind of dry humor, you know, when you talk about things. Because I'd be naturally very excited and I'm like very energized and sort of, I don't know, I can be a lot to take. And over time, I sort of absorbed this Irish kind of less is more. And I like that. You know?
Okay.
So I'm trying to learn that. Anyway.
Well, I'm delighted that you're here and enriching the country with what you do. And we'll put a link on our website to all the details for your film, Debutante. Thank you for giving us such an intriguing insight into your world. I've really enjoyed our conversation this morning. So thank you so much. And good luck to you with whatever you do.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Camila Dedina joining us on the programme this morning. The text number is always 51551.